Welcome to the 2022 Volume 2, Issue 2, Winter Podcast Edition, Part 1, of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion, published June 22, 2025. All contents are protected under the Creative Commons, Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives, 4.0 International Deed. For figures, citations, notes, and references, please refer to the printed articles at www.jpeonline.org. Part 1. Table of Contents. Asma Stephen T. and Rami Gabriel. 2020. Praise C. The Emotional Mind, The Effective Roots of Culture and Cognition. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 2, No. 2, 1-7. https://doi.org/10/33497/2020.winter.2. Flanagan, Owen. 2020. Emotional Correctness. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 2, No. 2, 8-16. https://doi.org/10/33497/2020.winter.3. Sukhbangre. 2020. The Emotional Mind and the Moral Mind. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 2, No. 2, 17-24. https://doi.org/10/33497/2020.winter.4. Cud and E. 2020. Wither Humanity. Emotional Mind Begs Rational Assessment. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 2, No. 2, 25-30. https://doi.org/10/33497/2020.winter.5.
Article 1. Praise C. The Emotional Mind, The Effective Roots of Culture and Cognition, by Stephen T. Asma and Rami Gabriel. When Darwin wrote The Origin of Species, 1859, page 424, he famously closed the book with a provocative promise that a light will be thrown on the origin of man and his history. In his Descent of Man, 1871, and his Expression of Emotions in Man and Animals, 1872, Darwin began to throw some of that promise light, especially regarding the emotional and cognitive similarities, homologies, of mammals. But shortly after this beacon, all went dark again. The rise of positivism in the early 20th century, paired with the turn toward genetics and the ascent of behaviorism, effectively lowered the curtain on biological speculations about the evolution of the mind. When researchers finally turned again to the mind in the mid-20th century, it was the computer that both sparked the cognitive sciences revolution and served as its exclusive investigative tool. Yet for all the successes of machine learning, and they are impressive, our understanding of biological minds seems to have gotten lost in the shuffle. While algorithmic digital computation produces problem-solving machines, such problem-solving, confusedly called intelligence by the dominant paradigm, lacks the obvious motivational goads and other effective triggers observed in real sentient animals. Even traditional evolutionary psychology, which should have been biologically oriented, gained popularity in the 1990s by actually ignoring the evolved nature of the brain and body in favor of postulated computational modules to explain human behavior in some largely mythical Pleistocene. Indeed, contemporary moral psychology and its philosophical counterpart often continue this modular approach, assuming the existence of innate normative switches in the human mind and discounting the emotional nature of ethical actions. With much less fanfare, the late 1990s saw the recognition of an effective science, especially in the pioneering work of Jake Panksepp, Antonio Damasio, and Richard Davidson. The field of effective neuroscience isolates emotional brain systems, largely in the regions of the brain that we share with other mammals, that undergird adaptive behaviors in vertebrates. With the help of neuroscientific and behavioral research, we are beginning to appreciate how the ancestral mammal brain is alive and well inside our higher neocortical systems. Unlike the computational approach to mind, the effective turn is deeply rooted in what we know about the brain as a biological reality. In the first decade of the new millennium, effective or emotional studies began to trickle into disciplines like ethology, e.g., Franz de Waal, economics, e.g., Daniel Kahneman, clinical practice, e.g., Jonathan Rottenberg and Mark Soames, and philosophy, e.g., Martha Nussbaum. But the time has finally come for a full-scale exploration of the evolution of emotions and mind in the biologically rooted human being. The effective roots of mind. In our new book, The Emotional Mind, The Effective Roots of Culture and Cognition, 2019, we argue that emotional systems are central to understanding the evolution of the human mind, as well as those of our primate cousins. We bring together insights and data from philosophy, biology, and psychology to shape a new research program. For at least 200 million years, the emotional brain has been under construction. By comparison, the focus of the cognitive approach, the expansion of the rational neocortex around 1.8 million years ago, is a latecomer on the scene, and the development of our language symbol system is younger still. As a suite of adaptive tools, the emotions have been at work substantially longer than rational cognition, so it makes little biological sense to think about the mind as an idealized, rational, cost-benefit computer projected into deep time. A sufficient account of the evolution of mind has to engage more than only the power of propositional thinking that is exemplified in our rarefied ability to manipulate linguistic representations. We will have to understand a much older capacity, the power to feel and respond appropriately. We need to analyze the evolution of mind in terms of layers of consciousness, i.e., the interaction between specifiable sets of functional systems. At the lower layers, we have basic drives that prod us and other animals out into the environment for the exploitation of resources. Thirst, lust, fear, and so on are triggers in evolutionarily earlier regions of the brain that stimulate vertebrates toward satisfaction and the return to homeostasis, physiological balance. At the lowest primary level, fear, for example, is radical. Under threat, the fearful animal voids its bowels and a surge of activity in the amygdala and hypothalamus readies it for defense or escape. The brain of mammals creates a feedback loop between these ancient affective systems and the next layer up, that which is responsible for the experiential learning and conditioning that a creature undergoes. At this secondary level, fear, to continue our example, becomes more specific. Rats are afraid of light, while humans are afraid of the dark. Same fear system, different threats. And finally, another feedback loop exists between the neocortical, rational cognitive processes and the aforementioned subcortical triggers and learning systems. At this top level, the tertiary level, fear is enmeshed with higher level conceptual and narrative thinking, producing the possibility for a culturally mediated experience, such as horror. Ruminations and thoughts, underwritten by language, symbols, executive control, and future planning, constitute this tertiary level, though they are energized by the lower level emotion. At this third level, we arrive at uniquely human emotions, like those elaborate and ephemeral feelings so beautifully articulated by introspective literary savants, such as Henry James, Fyodor Dostoevsky, and Edgar Allan Poe, in the case of horror. Tertiary affect and neocortical awareness have cognitive executive functions, such as the reflective intention to act, which is associated with the prefrontal cortex, rumination, and emotional regulation, which is associated with the medial frontal cortex, Panksepp, 1998. There are bottom-up causes of mind, i.e., those that push the organism to satisfy specific physiochemical requirements, but also top-down causes, i.e., those that regulate limbic experiences through neocortical cognitive and behavioral strategies, Panksepp, 2011. Conscious subjectivity does not suddenly arise at the top arc of this feedback circle. Rather, it exists throughout creatures of the mammalian clade as a foundational motivation process that is related to biological homeostatic triggers. Emotions in primary and secondary layers are sometimes thought of as unconscious, and even when we are regulating them, we do not have clear introspective conscious access to their functioning, Winkelmann and Berridge, 2001. It is thus more accurate to say that primary and secondary emotions have phenomenal consciousness, experiential feeling, but lack access consciousness, the ability to rationally access, manipulate, and reflect upon emotions, Block 2007. following our late mentor, Jake Panksepp, 1943 to 2017. We think all mammals share 7 foundational affective systems. Fear, lust, care, play, rage, seeking, and panic slash grief. Each of these has specific neural electrochemical pathways with accompanying feeling states and behavior patterns. Other researchers draw the map slightly differently regarding what counts as a primary emotion, but effective science should be able to iron out the best taxonomy in the decades to come. These 7 emotions are universal in humans and mammals, but they are filtered through the 3 layers of the emotional mind, creating tremendous diversity. The biological and psychological sciences have historically isolated or focused on one layer of mind to the exclusion of others, and thereby presented partial and sometimes conflicting pictures of mind and behavior. Many computationally oriented cognitive scientists tend to focus on tertiary level processing, while behaviorists focus on secondary level processing. We think the lowest layers of mind permeate, infiltrate, and animate the higher layers. The evolution of mind is the developmental story of how these layers emerged and acted as feedback loops on each other. Such feedback, however, does not exclusively take place in the brain. Rather, it is embedded in embodied, inactive, and sociocultural processes. The impressive achievements of a human cognitive niche are often heralded, but the emotional niche has gone unsung. We argue that the advances of complex tool industry, for example, or the evolution of family structures could not have happened without parallel advances in homo emotional life. An effective or emotional approach can demonstrate the surprising relevance of feelings to perception, thinking, decision-making, and social behavior. The mind is saturated with feelings. Almost every perception and thought has valence, or is emotionally weighted with some attraction or repulsion quality. Moreover, those feelings sculpted in the encounter between neuroplasticity and ecological setting provide the true semantic contours of mind. Meaning is foundationally a product of embodiment, our relation to the immediate environment and the emotional cues of social interaction, not abstract correspondence between sign and referent. The challenge then is to unpack this embodiment. How do emotions like care, rage, lust, and even playfulness create a successful social world for mammals, an information-rich niche for human learning, and a system for ideational salience? Our book strives to provide a conceptual roadmap to answer that question. The first chapter explains the motivation for our project by delineating how the study of affect clarifies lacunae in models of mind provided by behaviorism and cognitive science. The second chapter charts our ontological positions with an emphasis upon key issues in the philosophy of biology, including teleology, intentionality, determinism, causality, and developmental processes. Our debt to Aristotle and Spinoza reveals our deeper ontological position. Spinoza saw nature in fairly mechanical deterministic terms, but he recognized that living things share a simple, goal-oriented tendency. They strive to survive. He called this animation principle of living systems conatus, striving, and considered it the very essence of all biological creatures. It is nothing like the teleology of the natural theologians, but rather a recognition that nature has an essential goal-directed imperative within it that cannot be captured by purely billiard ball causation. Biological systems are themselves intentional. Equipped with conatus, proto-representational abilities, and homeostatic processes, creatures pursue maximum grip on their environments. Conative aboutness in homeodynamic systems is a kind of intentionality prior to decoupled representations. This line of thinking is a neglected teleological approach. Ecological teleology is an example of mammalian intentionality before the representational mind. Indeed, the latter could be derivative of the former. Cartesian and digital notions of mind have failed to incorporate this aspect of embodiment. We build a model of the evolution of the mind to include the diverse roles of emotion, beginning with an outline of a model of social intelligence and the foundation it provides for the phylogenetic and ontogenetic cultural accumulation of information. Our approach emphasizes the features of mental life that are homologous with non-human primates. Much of our understanding of primate ethology is gained through the work of primatologists Franz De Waal, Craig Stanford, Robert Sapolsky, and Sarah HRDY. We discuss a set of perceptual, emotional, and social processes as the proximal causes that enable culture and cultural learning as investigated by philosopher Kim Sterelny and psychologist Darshia Narvaez et al., 2013. Chapter 3 provides a theoretical model of social processes through considering how affordances transform the scope of perception, nonverbal communication, and the role of emotions therein. Chapter 4 delivers a phylogenetic story of social intelligence through a comparative analysis of primate social behavior in its ecological and emotional context. Chapter 5 suggests an ontogenetic narrative of the developmental psychology of social intelligence in the infant-caregiver relationship. Next, in Chapters 5 through 7, we trace affective systems through transformations that enabled representational mental processes, social organization, religion, and art. Our key principle is the notion of decoupling. When an affective response or a perceptual representation is freed from necessity, and it attaches onto and expands into other functions. Put another way, following philosopher Ruth Millikan, the human mind evolved the ability to separate or disconnect the indicative from the imperative functions of an image, sound, or memory. This provided enough distance from automatic action responses that representations could be manipulated, i.e., counterfactuals arose, and a second universe slowly emerged inside the head of Homo. Most contemporary work on the evolution of mind fails to address the way in which intellectual representations originated in earlier animal abilities. In this section of the book, we articulate an empirically informed model of how primates transitioned from bodily simulations, the beginnings of decoupling, to symbol systems, and how those eventual symbolic systems still bear the mark of their affective roots. Finally, in the final chapters, 8 and 9, we argue for the role of affect in the relationship between ontogenetics and group-level sociocultural adaptations and exaptations in social organization, religion, and art. Under increasing voluntary control, the pictorial and narrative faculty of imagination furnishes a bridge between passive sensual memory and associationism on the one hand and active adaptive appraisal or judgment, as well as mimetic cultural codification of survival strategies, on the other hand. We make a series of arguments for the emotionally therapeutic and pro-social aspects of religion, mythology, and art as adaptive functions of creativity. In those rare cases where researchers acknowledge an adaptive natural history of religion, they tend to offer cognitive interpretations, i.e., primitive religion is a crude proto-science that helps early man make predictions about and to understand nature. But this is an incomplete picture. Thus, we argue that the principal role of religion is to shape social solidarity through ritualized, affective sculpting. An affective approach to culture also helps us understand some stubborn contemporary confusions. New atheists, like Richard Dawkins and Dan Dennett, evaluate religion at the neocortical level. Their criterion for assessing its claims is the hypothetico-deductive method of verification. However, while religion may fail at the bar of rational validity, explanans, it is the wrong bar for evaluating religion. The limbic brain, built by natural selection for solving survival challenges, was not initially rational. Systems that culturally manage our emotions were selected for because they helped early mammals flourish. William James understood the tension between passional and rational agendas long before we had a neurological way of framing it. James recognized that faith is not knowledge in the strict sense, but since it is deeply meaningful in the affective domain, it is important to see how and why it might be warranted. He also understood that secular reason is more feeling-laden than we usually admit, that there is a sentiment of rationality that is worth exploring. Our book closes with an argument about how approaching the ethereal issue of faith with an appreciation of the affective roots of an emotional mind will allow for nuanced insight. Article 2, Emotional Correctness, by Owen Flanagan, Stephen Asma, and Rami Gabriels, 2019. The emotional mind provides a bottom-up genealogy of human life and culture built around the following theses. 1. There are universal emotions. 2. Emotions, primary or basic, are adaptations. 3. Emotions are psychobiological states. 4. Emotions are continuous between animals and humans. 5. The universal emotions have common phenomenal feels across instances, possibly across species. 6. Secondary and tertiary emotions are extended phenotypes built on or around the affective core of the primary emotions. 7. Pretty much every mental state is saturated with emotion. Page 63. 8. Intellectualist, computational, constructivist, and rationalist views of mind underestimate the affective aspects of mind, morals, and culture. 9. Top-down analysis of the emotions creates the illusion that emotions are more variable and propositional than they are. 10. Emotions change in response to local ecological demands, which include customs and conspecifics. Most such adjustments are the result of habituation, somatic marking, imitation, modeling, association, rather than instrumental reasoning or rational critique or social planning. Page 223. I have a few concerns about the defense Asma and Gabriel provide for some of these theses. I'll state one objection and leave the full development of it for another time. They claim that sameness of phenomenal feel is maintained across emotional instances in both the basic emotions, which importantly Asma and Gabriel often gloss in terms of basic affective systems rather than emotions as such and in extended phenotypes. There are at least three problems with the claim of common phenomenology. 1. At best, there is similarity, but nothing like identity, in behavior, brain, and bodily activation across instances of an emotion type, even in a single species, for example, in rats. 2. Phenomenological reports in humans depend on assumptions about accuracy in self-knowledge reports that we have reason to doubt. In support of the second criticism, the language of private mental events is much harder to teach, fix, and track than is the language for observables, e.g., red apples and such, and it is remarkably easy to get people to second-guess originally confident first-person reports about exactly what emotion they are feeling. An anger report can, upon questioning, be reconceived as a fear report. And I see a red apple is almost never reconceived as an I saw a green apple report. 3. How a human emotion seems or feels depends in part on what it is about. It is an unresolved question whether, and how we would know, that, for example, the fear of a snake and fear of losing a job are the same feeling fear-wise. If one favors individuating emotions widely rather than narrowly, they are not the same, nor do they feel the same. In emotion science and philosophy of emotion, phenomenal sameness and phenomenal continuity are matters of deep controversy, and not only between basic emotions theorists and constructionists, Scarantino and D'Souza 2018, Flanagan 2021. Debate about correctness, aptness, fittingness of moral emotions. For the rest of this critique, I focus on an argument that has some dialectical relation to 1 to 10 above, but that pertains specifically to the moral emotions, or, as I might say more accurately, to the emotions, the emotional norms, and the emotional scripts that humans almost invariably regulate normatively. By moral emotions I have in mind, as do Asma and Gabriel, Red Siege 8, especially 222 to 228, ones that often express moral attitudes and that are themselves subject to moral norms, scripts, and critique, such as anger, shame, guilt, pride, and compassion. These emotions often enact a morality, as when I get angry over injustice, and are governed by norms themselves, as in don't get too angry norms, or on the other side, norms that allow the judgment that one is insufficiently outraged at, e.g., an injustice. Every great moral tradition engages in questioning the aptness, fittingness, correctness of its ways of doing these emotions. Consider, for example, the Stoics who thought anger should be extirpated root and branch, thus challenging Aristotelians who thought that anger at the mean between too much and too little was justified. This was a debate about when anger was fitting. It was a third view offstage. The Onaterelle view that the emotion of anger should be as anger is entirely undomesticated. Both philosophical schools think that undomesticated anger doesn't suit our aims or our interests, doesn't align with the nature of ethics or with a proper understanding of metaphysics. The moral theory presents the arguments for right and wrong actions and for apt and inapt emotions. Asma and Gabriel are skeptical of the entire enterprise of assessing aptness, fittingness, and correctness for the emotions. The argument I have in mind occurs most explicitly in Chapter 4, Emotional Flexibility and the Evolution of Bioculture, pages 91 to 121, and Chapter 5, The Ontogeny of Social Intelligences, pages 91 to 152, and then again in Chapters 7 and 8, Language and Concepts, pages 184 to 203, and Effect in Cultural Evolution, pages 204 to 263. I hope the argument does not have a logical relation to 1 to 10 above, since I think the argument is weak, and it is highly consequential to all normative projects. The complaint is about the project of assessing emotions in terms of correctness, or what is also sometimes called aptness or fittingness. Asma and Gabriel write, at this point speaking specifically about the moral emotions. The biological and cultural genealogical investigation of moral emotions is productive and largely consilient with our view, but psychologists and philosophers who study moral emotions usually ignore their development and leap to create a taxonomy of such emotions or to discuss the interaction between emotion and rationality. Page 222. Earlier, Asma and Gabriel say that there is a tendency to examine emotions from the point of view of cognition, language, and reason that leads to an analysis of the correctness of emotions, which is a very bad idea. As Asma and Gabriel reason, the chief reason why language is a bad starting place for understanding emotions is that philosophers immediately become distracted by the search for criteria to designate when emotions are correct or incorrect. When we begin our analysis of emotions by tracking their appearance in language, it is but another short step to a place where we ask when emotions are justified or warranted, which can lead to a variety of other questions that treat emotions as a subset of belief or judgment. Page 146. In a sustained polemic that then runs several pages, especially pages 144 to 152, Asma and Gabriel do the following. 1. Take issue with the verificationist turn that animates so much philosophy of the emotions. Page 146. 2. Claim that it is symptomatic of the tendency to assimilate emotions to linguistic or propositional judgments to move immediately from recognizing the evaluative intentionality to asking about an emotion's correctness. Page 146. 3. Claim that the correctness approach commits a category error by conceiving emotions as an entirely propositional form of evaluation and involves looking for a correspondence theory of the emotions. Page 147. 4. Claim that asking about emotional correctness is to ask a question we should not care much about. Page 147. 5. Claim that correctness is normally assessed in the objectionable way by looking for aptness, fittingness, or correctness, which involves an assessment of whether the teleological function of the emotion is satisfied, where this involves assessing whether, e.g., that really is a snake, and sometimes also optimality judgments. Page 148. Is the emotion emotional script doing the best it can do, given what we aim to accomplish in this ecology? 6. Claim that trying to figure out when an emotion is correct without any appeal to evolutionary adaptation is a dubious approach. Page 147. 7. Eventually, we are told, the more suitable question for the emotions, however, is not their accurate representation of objective traits in the environment and optimal rational responses, but whether they are adaptive or maladaptive. To assume that the most adaptive response is the most rational is to misunderstand the nature of biology. A biological approach to the adaptive nature of emotions has no illusions about the rational optimality of the behavior. Almost nothing in biology, e.g., behaviors, traits, etc., is optimal, but is instead serviceable given the options at the time. Page 146. 8. They also give the following recommendation. We recommend taking the question of correctness of the emotions off the table entirely, at least as it is currently articulated. In its place remains the more interesting issue of the meaning of emotions. And here we see that the semantic content of our emotional lives is dictated originally by unique associational pairings of our mammalian affects and our earliest social environment of caregivers. Page 148. There's a lot going on here, and I have lost some hair trying to understand the argument and to give it the most charitable gloss. But I'll try to explain what I think is wrong. I think it best if Asma and Gabriel concede that they are entirely misguided about their anti-correctness argument. I think they can do that without undermining their underlying genealogy. I maintain neutrality, for now, on genealogy. Given the intellectual division of labor, claims about what are and are not the really interesting questions about emotions is not something most of us, really any of us, should have strong opinions about. If the project is genealogical, and especially if it is genealogical and anti-constructionist, a lot of emphasis will be placed on the ancient history of emotions and on the ways the core basic effects continue to do their work in extended phenotypes. But that's about the aims of very different projects, not a fact about what is really interesting and what isn't. There is nothing in the work of any philosophers I know, including the handful cited, who would deny that emotions involve bodily feelings, and in addition would deny overall commitment to some version of Dobzhansky's dictum, 1973, in Nothing in Biology Makes Sense Except in the Light of Evolution. Dobzhansky's dictum involves rejection of creationist and theistic genealogies of morals. But note that the scope of Dobzhansky's dictum is biology. Naturalists in philosophy will want to be careful not to say anything inconsistent with our best science. But analyzing emotional correctness is, as far as I can tell, utterly consistent with the principles of the neo-Darwinian consensus. Clearly, ordinary humans, as well as ethicists and social and political philosophers, spend enormous amounts of time and energy talking about the aptness of various emotions in various situations, as well as whether we should adjust our culturally endorsed scripts for enacting emotions. For example, if it isn't a snake, then you really need not be scared. Or, to choose another example, given the level of anger in America today, we might want to talk about whether our normative scripts and permissions for feeling, expressing, and enacting anger fit the teleological function of anger and satisfy or optimize our collective goals. We can ask such questions about tokens or types. Such talk is sensible and ubiquitous, and normally assumes nothing about whether the core phenomenal feel of anger is maintained from the Pleistocene, or is the same as a chimp's anger, or even that my anger that the president is a racist is phenomenally similar to my anger that I'm stuck in interminable traffic. It does, however, involve judgments about whether the cultured emotion of anger fits the situation and aligns with cultural norms. There is, in fact, a huge cultural variation in, again, to choose the example I know a lot about, norms of anger. Leaving aside the thorny question of whether all the kinds of anger feel the same, which I doubt, it is evident that what is supposed to cause anger and how one is supposed to enact anger varies greatly. Sure, the kids might be habituated in these norms without being also provided their rationale. But the grown-ups can articulate their rationales, which normally involve correctness conditions. These conditions involve evaluations of such matters as whether that person really just made a sexist remark, which are intended to assess whether the culturally endorsed teleological function of anger is met, e.g., you're supposed to get angry at sexism, and then to offer a different assessment of whether the response was of the right sort given the culturally endorsed norms for the expression of anger. Again, the assessment is about whether the emotion of anger is fitting, correct, or apartment. Asma and Gabriel make a lot out of this point in their argument against theorizing about moral correctness. Trying to figure out when an emotion is correct without any appeal to evolutionary adaptation is a dubious approach, page 147. But here I think they make too much of the idea of emotions as evolutionary adaptations. Let's distinguish, as is commonly done, between the ancient and modern historical senses of adaptation. One historical function of anger was to motivate me to scare you away from my food or my mate, and thus was fitness enhancing. In a modern world, the anger that originally evolved to motivate me to chase you with threats of fists, sticks, and stones now equips me with guns and nuclear weapons. Still fitness enhancing? It's not clear. The main point is that when moral theorists assess emotional aptness for shame, guilt, and anger, they are not normally assessing their ancient history fitness functions. They are assessing their contemporary flourishing functions. Regarding the extended phenotypes of many moral emotions, shame, guilt, love, compassion, and forgiveness, they often have as their rationale that they are conducive to human flourishing. Flourishing often has no direct relation to biological fitness. To give a non-moral example, consider literacy. Literacy is good and conducive to human happiness, but it is not an adaptation in either the ancient or modern history senses of a biological adaptation. Humans were illiterate until 5,000 years ago for the first 240,000 years of species history. Literacy is a cultural, not a biological invention, and literacy currently is inversely correlated with fertility, which is a decent measure of biological fitness. The upshot is that moral emotions such as anger and guilt and shame have natural species histories that may well involve primitive affective systems that we have inherited from our ancestors, but that doesn't mean that their main current work is still playing that role, or only that role. It looks to me as if many moral emotions are exaptations or secondary adaptations, or more radically still, that their job and scope has become increasingly aligned with projects of human flourishing and less aligned with the goals of fitness. Flourishing requires fitness. Well, it requires being alive, but it doesn't require that the moral emotions any longer continue to function primarily, mainly, or only as sustainers and protectors of inclusive genetic fitness. Overall, I think Asma and Gabriel make way too much of ancient history functions of emotions and attend too little to their modern history forms and functions. Normative theorists are fully entitled to engage in all forms of correctness, aptness, and fittingness analyses, and to assess, one, whether in its current token or type form an emotion has the object it is supposed to have by the culturally endorsed norms. So that, for example, moral anger is in fact a response to an actual injustice as opposed to you getting in the way of my egoistic desires. Two, whether the actual object, e.g., the injustice, the misunderstood remark, my shitty mood, warrants the response the person is disposed to take or has taken. And three, whether the token or the type accomplishes the job we want, e.g., does it adequately call attention to an injustice? Or does it miss doing that and simply humiliate another human being? Or is it consistent with our other values and norms, and so on? Conclusion. I have focused my criticism on a certain overreach in Stephen Asma and Rami Gabriel's fine book. The emotions have a natural history that sets parameters on their cultured forms. But the modern forms of moral emotions such as shame, guilt, and anger are radically different from their ancient forms. When we assess whether such emotions are apt or fitting, we are engaged in a perfectly acceptable project that deploys cultural, not biological, criteria of goodness, rightness, and flourishing. Article 3. The Emotional Mind and the Moral Mind, by Bongray Sook. The Emotional Mind is a book of a grand vision. It attempts to provide a full-scale exploration of the evolution of emotions and mind in the biologically rooted human being, page 2. The authors, Stephen Asma and Rami Gabriel, 2019, argue that emotional systems are central to understanding the evolution of the human mind, as well as that of our primate cousins, by bringing insights and data from philosophy, biology, and psychology to shape a new research program, page 2. Their approach to the emotional mind is not only philosophical and psychological, but also biological, anthropological, social, and cultural. They develop a comprehensive and carefully organized analysis of the extended, embedded, and inactive nature of emotion that many conventional approaches, such as those of the computational, propositional, or modular models of the emotional mind, do not provide. Asma and Gabriel argue that emotion is not just limited to the psychological, but should also be extended into the broad realm of the biological with its evolutionary history. Social norms have been shaped by and constructed with effect management, page 204. The invention of tools and sophisticated use of language are founded upon the process of emotional modernity, page 7. The cognitive mind and its representational capacity are derived from imaginative and decoupled effect, pages 153 to 183. Intentionality is deeply rooted in conative aboutness, page 17. The social and cultural mind have been developed by stimulating and managing emotion, pages 204 to 263. And the role of religion is that of shaping social solidarity through ritualized effect sculpting, pages 264 to 310. The emotional mind, therefore, is a book of an ambitious research project. Its goal is to demonstrate that effective adaptation to the specific ecological and social topography of human groups is a causal factor in the creation, maintenance, and eventual change of the social norms that define culture and organization, page 18. I think Asma and Gabriel's project provides an inspiring support for the new wave of the effective turn that focuses on the embodied and emotional human experience that is foundational and pervasive in the inner mind and the outer world, but not fully captured by cognitive and formal methodologies. However, I found some inconsistencies and limitations in their explanation of emotion, in general, and moral emotions, in particular. In the following sections, I will discuss their views on the unity of emotion, emotion as a natural kind, the evolution of self-critical moral emotions, and the tripartite layers of the mind. Unity and diversity of emotion. Asma and Gabriel assume that emotion is a natural kind of psychology, or at least believe in the unitary conception of emotion. Although they do not explicitly discuss whether emotion is a natural kind or not, they seem to believe that emotion has a categorical or projectable unity in psychology and neuroscience, and argue for its pervasive presence in all stages of human evolution and human psychology. By following the works of Panksepp, DeMaceo, and Davidson, they state that effective neuroscience isolates emotional brain systems, largely those regions of the brain we share with other animals, that undergird adaptive behaviors in vertebrates, page 2. They define emotion through terms such as the power to feel and respond appropriately, page 3, and the satisfaction and return to homeostasis, page 3. Considering the diverse processes and functions observed in different forms or types of emotion, however, this unified notion of emotion could invite inconsistencies or confusions. Emotion may not be a natural kind. Some scholars such as Nussbaum, 2001, and Solomon, 1976, believe that emotions are judgments with cognitive, imagistic, conceptual, or propositional content, while others see emotions at a level where ascription of any such cognitive content is impossible or nonsensical, specifically in animals and young children's minds. Although the diverse functions of emotion can occur together, their distinct processes identified and studied separately. There are many of these seemingly uniform and consistent, but clearly distinct psychological processes. For example, empathy has been understood as a unified or singular function of the mind. However, recent brain imaging studies report that there are at least three different types of empathy: cognitive, affective sharing, and prosocial motivation, with different processes and functions, Desity and Cowell, 2014. These studies demonstrate that what most people or philosophers call empathy is, in fact, a group of interrelated but distinct processes. One may argue that these different forms of empathy share a common psychological property, i.e., a vicarious and other concerning emotional state. However, studies of selective impairment of empathy in psychopathy and autism show that they are not simply different versions of the same empathy, but very different empathies. Perhaps the same can be true of emotion as a unified and projectable category of psychology. Although different forms of emotion interact with each other or share some processes together, they serve different functions, utilize different processes or mechanisms, and are affected differently by brain damage. One can argue, perhaps, that Asma and Gabriel do not need to abandon their grand view of effectivism because of the complexity or heterogeneity of emotion. Even though emotion is not a natural kind, One can still argue for the pervasive and consistent nature of affect through the various types of emotional states in different levels and stages of social evolution and human psychology. The two, i.e., the conceptually unified and theoretically projectable notion of emotion and the pervasive presence of affect, although interrelated, are different issues that can be studied and argued for or against on separate grounds. Even though Asma and Gabriel are wrong in assuming the unity of emotion at the fundamental level of affect, they can still argue for the pervasiveness of diversely manifested affect in the human mind, society, and civilization. However, it is still important to understand and to discuss the nature of the two issues so that the former is not used to support the latter or vice versa. Shame and guilt. Among the inspiring hypotheses and analyses developed in this book, Asma and Gabriel's explanation of moral emotion is very stimulating. They argue that our intuitive moral sense has evolved through different stages or levels of evolution. Specifically, in the process of evolution, moral emotions are internalized and universalized, or, to use Asma and Gabriel's terminology, decoupled from the original environment of their evolution, to become adaptive to the changing conditions of their social and cultural environments. Shame and guilt, for example, are the kind of emotions that are evolved from foundational affects to specialized emotions because they impose an internalized, self-directed psychological sanction in two different ways. Asma and Gabriel clearly point out this unique aspect of shame and guilt, but their explanation misses important psychological properties of shame. Asma and Gabriel's discussion focuses on a specific form of shame that serves a regulative function similar to that of guilt. Both shame and guilt impose regulative inner sanction to the minds of moral or social violators and play important preventive roles for their future violations. They state that emotions like shame, guilt, and forgiveness are fostered in religion because they are highly adaptive in shaping behaviors within large-scale cooperative social ecologies, and add that the feelings of shame and guilt are, at bottom, the secondary-level limbic feelings of privation and social alienation. These feelings might be explicit in the overt ostracism of the community, or they might be implicit in the virtual ostracism of the penitent's mind, page 301. This type of shame is a form of shame evolved from an earlier form of self-protective awareness that served to signal subordination and appeasement in front of highly ranked individuals in a social hierarchy for the purpose of dominance negotiation and peace, Fessler 1999, Gilbert 1989, 1992, Keltner and Harker 1998. If one does not display an appropriate signal, one may be attacked by socially or physically dominant individuals. Shame, or proto-shame, is such a sense of self-protection. This type of shame is observed in some social animals, such as primates, and is homologous with the evolved shame that Asma and Gabriel discuss in this book. In addition, there is another form of shame that serves ideal moral functions. In this form, shame is no longer a feeling of being ashamed in front of others, but a sense of moral excellence and integrity. This type of shame is discussed in classical Confucian texts, such as the Analects, Leg 1960a, and the Mencius, Leg 1960b, and became a strong moral virtue in Confucian tradition. Confucius designates it as one of the central virtues of Confucianism, Analects 1320, Leg 1960a, page 271, and Mencius takes it as one of the moral sprouts, the innate moral tendencies of the mind. Mencius 2, A6, Leg 1960b, page 203. From a perspective of self-imposed moral excellence, this type of shame is comparable to guilt, although it is only analogous, not homologous, to guilt, Suk 2017, pages 68 to 9. Therefore, there are at least three different forms of shame: subordination shame, social shame, and moral shame, Suk 2017, pages 64 to 7. But the shame that Asma and Gabriel discuss in this book, I think, is regulative social shame, page 301. If my interpretation is appropriate, Asma and Gabriel's discussion does not represent the whole scope and the full foundation of shame. As a result, their explanation of shame is limited. Their approach to shame is not applicable to all forms of shame, specifically to inner moral shame of classical Confucianism. Dialectic process and co-opting process. Asma and Gabriel develop a distinct dialectic approach to emotion by criticizing both the constructionist and the modularist approaches to emotion. First, they argue that their view does not support psychological constructionism, such as Barrett's 2006. They state that the lowest layers of the mind permeate, infiltrate, and animate the higher layers, page 10. They add that the evolution of mind is the developmental story of how these layers emerged and acted as feedback loops on each other. And it's important to foreshadow here that such feedback is not strictly a brain process, but an embodied, inactive, and sociocultural process, page 10. Second, they argue that their approach is not modularist either, page 14 and 222. They state that, your own view is that emotions are open-ended, domain-general, feeling-slash-behavior matrices that adapt to the influence of culture and cognition to play a horizontal and vertical role in human and mammalian learning and social living. Page 211. And add that, UST, as we think, domain-specific modularity mischaracterizes the flexibility and plasticity of non-social cognition. So, two, social intelligence seems an even less likely candidate for dedicated encapsulated circuitry. Page 211. Can they navigate between the Scylla and Charybdis of constructionism and modularism and successfully find their shelter without facing any challenges? The key to finding a successful middle point between the two lies in the continuity and dialectic transformation of emotion in the layers of the mind. According to Asma and Gabriel, there are three layers or levels in the evolution of emotion. They use metaphors, such as a layer cake or Russian dolls, to explain the layers created by a dialectic process of evolution that links the mind, the body, and the brain, page 8. They criticize the exclusive focus on a single layer, the tertiary or the primary layer, at the cost of other layers of the mind, often observed in some psychological studies, page 9, and ask for a more balanced and holistic approach to the mind, cognition, and emotion. Yet they seem to think of these layers as distinct individual layers of the mind. They state, for example, that we will have to think about consciousness itself as an archaeologist thinks about layers of sedimentary strata, page 3. That is, these layers are related but not identical layers, shaped by interactive and continuous, i.e., dialectic, processes. If we take Asma and Gabriel's, page 10, notion of transformation seriously, each layer is interrelated but is also an intrinsically different layer resulting from a transformative process. If these layers all originate from the same foundation of effect, how do they become different layers? There are two possible answers to this question. The dialectic continuous, interactive and constructive process and the co-option, additive, discrete, and integrative process. The difference between the dialectic process and the co-option process can be understood in the following way. Consider a rainbow of colors where different colors coexist and new colors are added without changing or replacing the existing colors in the arc. Compare them to the colors of an LCD screen where the colors of the light sources, such as red, blue, and green, with their varying combinations and interactions, generate new unitary colors, such as pink, purple, etc. The former is an additive system of colors, but the latter is an interactive, continuous, and constructive, i.e., dialectic, system of colors. Some of our emotions, such as disgust and shame, come to exist as new colors of a rainbow of emotions without the dialectic, i.e., continuous and constructive, interaction among the existing emotions. Although the layers, i.e., phases or stages, of the dialectic process look distinctive, as purple looks distinctive in comparison with its pre-existing elements such as red, blue, and green. And Asma and Gabriel use the term strata to distinguish different stages or phases of this process of evolution. The strata are the interactive and emergent combinations of the underlying or pre-existing elements. Because of these characteristics, therefore, Asma and Gabriel's dialectic process, even with distinct strata, does not fully explain the evolution of emotions such as disgust and shame that come to exist through an additive process of co-option. Asma and Gabriel believe that the dialectic process of affect can explain the continuity and transformation of affect by combining the diversity, transformation, and the unity, consistency, of emotion through its evolutionary adaptations in the three layers. However, the dialectic and transformative spiral does not spin nicely in some areas of moral psychology. As I discussed in the previous section, shame and perhaps disgust do not follow this dialectic model because the way shame develops its new forms is not dialectical through the decoupling process, but co-optive or additive. The process of co-option, which I believe took place not just once but twice in the evolutionary history of shame and disgust, is different from the process of the dialectic construction of emotion. Co-option is a conservative tinkering process where new functions are added to the existing functions, yet the existing functions are not completely replaced by the new ones. For example, if all forms of shame, such as social shame and moral shame, retain seemingly unnecessary psychological properties, such as their vestigial features of lowering the body or covering the face by an individual who feels shame, that derive from the ancient form of shame, subordination shame. This additive combination of the old with the new properties of shame can be observed in classical Confucian texts, where ideal moral shame comes with the vestigial features of having a specific audience / spectator or with a lowering posture, i.e., distinctive features of subordination shame. The duplication or repetition of the base form of shame in the evolved forms of shame is not just a strange psychological effect, a simple confusion, or a literary imagination. According to Clark, 2010, this type of duplication or repetition is a form of homology, serial, not taxic homology, observed in biological organs in some animal species. For example, bats have two different kinds of appendages, feet and hand phalanges, serving different functions in the same body, just as people experience two different forms of shame in their minds. That is, new forms of shame, social shame and moral shame, are not evolved from a dialectical process from the ancient shame, subordination shame, but are evolved from a co-opting process and coexist with some features of the ancient shame. What this implies is that the new layers of the mind or affect do not exist through the transformative change of the base layers, but through the accumulative and conservative change of adding new layers to an old layer. That is Asma and Gabriel's notion of a stratified layer with a dialectic process of transformation, i.e., a continuous yet transformative and distinctive stage in the evolution of emotion, is different from the notion of a layer or stage in a co-opted process. They argue that new layers are continuous with old layers because the lowest layers of the mind permeate, infiltrate, and animate the higher layers. Page 10. They also argue that new layers are dialectically transformative of old layers because emotions are open-ended and domain-general, and adaptable to the influence of culture and cognition. Page 10. However, the combination of continuity and dialectic transformation in their notion of layer does not necessarily provide a good explanation of the evolution of emotion. Different forms of disgust and shame, for instance, can be explained by a co-optive process where new psychological elements are added to an existing foundation of emotion without the continuous and dialectically transformative change that Asma and Gabriel are looking for in their stratified layers in the evolution of emotion. A distinctive stage, i.e., a layer, in an evolutionary process does not have to be continuous with and transformative of its previous stages, as Asma and Gabriel believe. It can be a stage of a discrete and additive process of co-option. Despite the questions I raised about the unity, diversity, and evolution of emotion, Asma and Gabriel's effort to develop a new way of understanding emotion is inspiring and instigating. Although the integrative process that they envision as the evolutionary process of emotion is different from the additive and partially duplicative co-optive process of moral emotions, their explanation of the dialectic and transformative process in the tripartite layers of the mind stimulates a new approach to emotion that the cognitive, constructivist, or modularist explanations of emotion do not provide.
Article 4. Wither Humanity, Emotional Mind Begs Rational Assessment, by Anee Cudd, The Emotional Mind by Stephen T. Asma and Rami Gabriel, 2019, sketches an ambitious research agenda that centers the explanation and understanding of human experience in our embodied emotional makeup. The book traces the evolutionary development of emotion from earlier mammalian and primate hormonal chemistry and bodily structures and the resulting dispositions and abilities, arguing for a new evolutionary paradigm in the understanding of mind, knowledge, and culture. They infer from the fact that we are evolved biological beings that if the human mind is in fact an evolutionary kluge, it must, in some respects, still function in an embodied, extended, embedded, non-conceptual manner. Asma and Gabriel, 2019, page 154. The book aims to serve as a corrective to paradigms that focus on cognition and rationality and set humans apart from their primate and mammalian relatives and ancestors. Although this book may well outline a good positive agenda for research on the contribution of emotion to thought, interpersonal connection and strife and culture, it mischaracterizes the role that rationality and philosophical theories of rationality play in understanding and shaping our experience. Furthermore, the book is insufficiently critical about the emotional origins of the theories it explores, leading to its uncritical acceptance of androcentric ideas, and it all but ignoring the great and growing problems of group-based inequality. Asma and Gabriel rightly criticize writers like Steven Pinker, 2018, for being overly enthusiastic about the prospects for an increasingly egalitarian future based in scientific rationality, but they also underappreciate the degree to which our emotions and emotionally laden cultural constructs like religion have condemned us to a contemporary world of oppression and strife. Without robust rationality and critical moral thinking, along with evolutionary adaptations about our emotion-based urges and biases, we cannot hope for a better future. Rational choice theory as normative, not descriptive. Asma and Gabriel rightly criticize many modern philosophical theories of rationality and morality for portraying humans as primarily motivated by higher cognition, while not bothering to try to explain how cognition develops biologically and evolutionarily. For example, the intentional rational choice approach to action is agnostic about whether the agent is even a biological being. Without specificity of the kind of being and its embodied characteristics, they argue, the theory is impoverished. The question of how an action is intentional requires elaborate theoretical calisthenics in a cognitive paradigm that has a place for neither the wide range of abilities enabled by basic affective mechanisms, nor the embodied nature of cognition, Asma and Gabriel, 2019, page 30. While I agree that understanding how our evolved, embodied dispositions, as well as the ecologies and evolutionary niches that proto-humans and then Homo sapiens inhabited during our development, is crucial to explaining how we came to the habits of mind and social behaviors that characterize modern humans, I also think that Asma and Gabriel go too far in their critique of rationality. Crucially, they confuse descriptive and normative uses of rationality in prudential, moral, and social theorizing. One critique they make is that the rational choice approach already circumscribes the process of driving behavior too narrowly and over-idealizes the agent. Asma and Gabriel, 2019, page 218. In particular, the theory posits that rational agents act to maximize their own individual interest or utility. Yet this seems to be clearly contradicted by common observation of our behavior. Against the standard rational agent model, the affective systems complicate the causal story of social behaviors like cooperation and competition. Many of us will be loyal to a friend even when it gives us no advantage, and even when less noted, we disagree with the friend that advantage will at least accrue to them. Asma and Gabriel, 2019, page 219. This critique rings true as long as we are talking about explaining how people in fact behave. But if we want to take a critical look at how people should behave, it is not clear that rational choice theory would recommend against behaving loyally in a long-run scenario. After all, dispositions to behave loyally can bring advantages that cannot be foreseen. It is in one's best interest generally to maintain friendships and alliances, and to have the reputation for doing so. If on some particular occasion it really isn't possible to derive an advantage from a particular act of loyalty, then it may in fact not be good to behave that way. As the saying goes, the only people I owe my loyalty to are those who never made me question theirs. For example, my favorite moral theory, mutual advantage contractarianism, relies on our ability to commit to a long-run disposition to do the right thing without considering short-run advantage, even when that appears to be irrational from a cost-benefit perspective. Rationality alone does not generate this disposition reliably because it tells us to always do what is in our best interest, and that can motivate us to cheat on those commitments if we think we can get away with it. Love and loyalty can override rationality, just when we need them to help bolster the commitment that is in our long-run best interest to adhere to. This is just to say, though, that we need rationality and emotion to be able to do the otherwise hard right things. Rational choice theory and especially moral theory are, in my view, primarily normative theories. In their normative role, they tell us how we should live rather than predictions about how people do live. It is true that rational choice theory is foundational in economics, which has primarily descriptive aims. But even in economic theory, the behavioral economics turn, which reveals the limits of rationality for predicting human behavior, is being incorporated into mainstream economics, right alongside and in combination with rational choice theory. While it is clear that our behavior does not always follow the dictates of the latter theory, no economist would suggest that I should not use a rationality-based investment strategy, informed by my preferences about when and how I wish to retire, to build my retirement portfolio. Rational choice theory and rationality-based moral or political theories are not falsified by human failures to live by them, even by systematic failures. It is true that for these theories to provide much guidance, our emotional makeup must allow us to behave according to them. But Asma and Gabriel explain at length how our mental and emotional makeup is highly plastic, and nothing they have said shows that we cannot constrain behavior at least some of the time by our conscious, rational thoughts. Consider, again, rational investment strategies. So, my suggestion is why not accept the limited role that rationality can play and incorporate it into the development of human emotional and social life? At one point, Asma and Gabriel sympathetically quote Kim Sterelny, 2012, suggesting something along this line. Prosocial and commitment emotions evolved before moral cognition. They made possible the cooperation and cultural learning that prepare the evolution of explicit normative thought. Asma and Gabriel, 2019, page 120. Rationality and moral cognition are recent developments in our evolutionary history, to be sure. But it is surely useful for taking a critical view toward our emotional dispositions and their social and cultural outgrowths, and not to be dismissed as merely a provincial worldview. Asma and Gabriel, 2019, page 293. Androcentric bias. Asma and Gabriel would do well, as we all would, to consider how their androcentric perspective skews their understanding of the affective paradigm. In particular, it biases their view of affect-laden human development. For example, the descriptions of lust and anger, Asma and Gabriel 2019, page 80 and 82, seem to me to rely too heavily on male experience and tend to portray human females as mere objects of male subjectivity. Second, their analysis of shame, Asma and Gabriel 2019, pages 252-3, begs a feminist reading, such as that provided by Sandra Bartke, 1990. She argues that shame is a prevailing emotion for women that maintains male dominance. Shame in women is not about morality, as guilt is, but about social submission, keeping women in their place. Third, Asma and Gabriel uncritically accept attachment theory without mention of the problematic aspects of the theory, despite the searing feminist criticisms to which the theory has been subjected, R. 1993. Finally, their description of current nuclear family, Asma and Gabriel 2019, page 209, dynamics reads like a description of 1950s white middle-class domesticity. None of this condemns their overall project of developing the affective paradigm, which may itself serve well as a good feminist corrective to the cognitive and rationality paradigms. But applying a feminist critical lens should be high on the research agenda if it is to avoid these and other androcentric biases. Need to overcome effective roots of oppression. In addition to a better understanding of how the human mind and sociality has evolved in our primate bodies, though we need a rationality theory and moral theories based in rationality in order to identify unjust individual and interpersonal behavior and systematically oppressive social policies. The authors explain well how big man groups, Asma and Gabriel 2019, page 207, would have arisen from the emotional makeup of early humans, but they do not identify or critique the inequality and oppressiveness of such groups. Furthermore, their theories explain only inequality within social groups. Yet to assume that our emotions and sex-based hormones tell the entire story of inequality is to suggest that inequality is entirely natural and immutable. This ignores the struggles for and progress toward equality and dignity that have occurred throughout human history. Humans clearly have the ability to develop a sense of justice, based in rationality, and to take a stand against emotion-laden, cultural constructs that reinforce inequality and oppression. We would do well not to ignore that ability and evidence of its history in our quest for a better understanding of human experience in our embodied emotional makeup. This marks the end of the 2022 Volume 2, Issue 2 Winter Podcast Edition, Part 1, of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion. Please go to 2022 Volume 2, Issue 2 Winter Podcast Edition, Part 2, of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion, to continue listening to this issue.